We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. Area 51 is the most famous and the most secret military installation in the world. Now, to many, no doubt, it represents the underworld of aliens and captured UFOs. And in fact, this has been a place where secret government work has gone on, but perhaps not the kind of secret government work that people will think of. Investigative reporter Annie Jacobson, our guest for this hour of the show, she says the truth is that Area 51 was set up to make the United States the leader in advanced military science, and it still does that kind of work today. This morning in this hour of the show, we will talk with Annie Jacobson about her recent book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Little Brown is the publisher, and it's out recently. Our guest, Annie Jacobson, is contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine. She's an investigative reporter whose work has also appeared in the National Review and the Dallas Morning News. She wrote a two-part series on Area 51, The Road to Area 51, that was published in the LA Times Magazine, and a lot of people read that. She's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions are welcome. We hope people will stay on the topic if they call in and be as brief as they can so we can keep moving along, but anybody who wants to participate in the conversation can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also have an email that's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And Ms. Jacobson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, beginning with the acknowledgement that as far as the United States government is concerned, Area 51 doesn't exist. Area 51 actually is a real place. If you had the permission, you could actually go there and stand on the ground of Area 51. So where exactly is Area 51?
It is located in southern Nevada, about 75 miles north of Las Vegas. And to begin to understand Area 51, let me place it for you in terms of geography.
Mm-hmm.
Area 51 sits inside a larger land parcel that is called the Nevada Test and Training Range. And that piece of land is a little bit smaller than the state of Connecticut. It is entirely federally restricted. You can't go there. Inside of that is also the Nevada test site, which is 1,000 and change square miles of a nuclear bombing range, which beginning in the 1950s, America exploded 100 atmospheric nuclear bombs there, which was one of the first things that really caught my interest when I was researching Area 51, because I didn't know that. Now, I was born in 1967, so I'm much younger than most of my sources by about half the age. But I was really surprised to learn I had heard of all these atomic tests in the Pacific, and I was very interested to learn that actually we set off these atomic bombs next door to Area 51 in these different quadrants, Area 1, 2, 3, up to about Area 30. So it makes perfect sense that you would have this secret facility inside a secret facility next to a secret facility.
Mm-hmm. So clearly this is a place that is a restricted area, both because what's going on there is hazardous and dangerous, and also for reasons of national security. The U.S. government wouldn't want to make sure that that during the Cold War it would have been the Soviet Union or anybody else would not know what it was exactly that was going on there.
Exactly. And one of the earliest CIA men who was really responsible for setting up the CIA part of the base, his name was Richard Bissell. And he's most famous for his involvement in the Bay of Pigs. That led to his downfall and resignation. But years before that, he was out in the desert setting up Area 51 on this land parcel, which is made up, centers around a dry lake bed called Groom Lake. And it was a perfect place for the U-2 spy plane, which was Bissell's sort of addition to the CIA in many remarkable ways. That was a great place to land the U-2 spy plane because a dry lake bed is perfectly flat. It's like a natural runway.
Hmm. And just to make sure people understand that this, what might sound like this very mysterious designation, it was just a way the territory was divided up into geographic areas. They plotted them out. And so presumably there's an Area 50 and there's an Area 52. It's just that each one had a number, and that's how they identified the small parcels geographically.
Well, yes and no, and that's part of the great enigma that is Area 51, and I write about that in the end of the book. But what is true is that the original parcels, Area 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth, in the lower numbers, were divided out as part of the Nevada test site.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing between approximately Area 30 and Area 51. There are no Area 40s that we know of.
So that's odd. Someone just decided this, just picked a number out of the air. It would say, well, we're going to take this spot and we're going to call it 51.
Well, there's people disagree with me, but one of my sources told me that the reason it was called Area 51 was because in 1951, a very, very top secret program came out to the base and was set up there, and it was the designation of the year 51.
Oh, okay. Well, you had this experience that I'm sure all reporters dream of. Someone sidled up to you and said, literally said to you, have I got a story for you? And in fact, this was the story. And the person was a physicist, a man who's named Edward Lubbock, who had worked had done work there at Area 51. And he had been the guy who had really helped to develop, had really been behind the development of stealth technology, and was apparently was very much involved in developing these planes that were used for very high altitude surveillance. Planes like, and you mentioned the U-2, planes like the U-2. So tell us about your meeting with Edward Lubbock.
Well, that, and you're absolutely right. It's sort of like a reporter's dream. And I was at a Christmas dinner party, and I had known Lubbock. And he leaned over to me. He was 88 years old at the time. This was Christmas 2007, and he said exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
And what he revealed stunned me, because it was not only was he the, what I call the grandfather of stealth technology, but all of his life's work had, in essence, been kept secret since Eisenhower was president, because it was classified. And so here it was. He was an old man, and the CIA decided to declassify, and he could suddenly speak of it. And, you know, we had the most marvelous time talking about what he worked on, and I tell you, it had to be brought way back for me. And imagine trying to understand stealth technology from the guy who developed it. And I had a remarkable experience as a reporter, because instead of talking highbrow with me, Lubbock, in all his infinite wisdom, made it so simple. When I was trying to understand what stealth was, what is radar evading technology? I mean, it sounds like you'd need a PhD in physics to understand it. And Lubbock spent hours talking to me using analogies, and I share this with a reader in the book, about talking about how a bat works with echolocation. It will send out a squeak to find a bug. The squeak will hit the bug out in the air, and then the signal will come back to the bat, and it will know where to go. Then Lubbock would explain to me how camouflage worked, using metaphors also from the natural world, everything from how the Arctic fox turns brown in winter, or the chameleon, which, you know, we get the whole idea of camouflage from the name of the chameleon. And this was one of the most joyful parts of reporting the book, having these brilliant scientists and engineers who are clearly at the top of their game, because you don't wind up doing work for government agencies at Area 51 unless you are at the top. And yet their ability to make things so simple, I think, makes for a really interesting read, in that readers don't have to have degrees in science to understand what was going on.
Yeah. Just very quickly, I'll introduce again the guest for anybody who might have just tuned in. Annie Jacobson is talking with us. She's an investigative reporter, contributing editor at the LA Times Magazine, author of the new book Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Little Brown is the publisher. 333-9455 800-222-9455. He was also, Edward Lubbock was also involved in developing another one of these very sophisticated high-tech, high-altitude spy planes, a plane called the A-12. And at the time that he talked to you, that had been almost half a century, but it was only recently declassified, and that was why he could talk about it. Why at that point, you wonder why it was still classified, because they weren't even, I don't think even they were making this plane anymore, but why at that point did they finally decide that could be declassified? And then that made it possible for him to and other people to talk about what they had done.
Well, that's right, and that actually is a mystery. I'll speculate that on in a moment, but first I just would like to say that what was so interesting about the A-12 Oxcart, because, of course, no one had ever heard of it or very few people had heard of it before 2007, but many of us had actually seen its cousin, because the SR-71, that famous Air Force plane, also called the Blackbird, was actually the follow-on program of the A-12. They look identical, except for the SR-71 has a second seat for a flight engineer. And so, lo and behold, we find out that actually it was the CIA who developed that amazing plane, not the Air Force. And as I write in my book about this power struggle that went on at Area 51 over who was going to control the Blackbird, and ultimately the Air Force won. But, you know, one of the questions that I often ask is exactly the question that you asked me. Why did the CIA declassify this program in 2007? Because certainly for me, it allowed me to be able to talk with all of my sources about their work at Area 51. Before that, they couldn't. And then while the declassified CIA documents never reference Area 51, they always reference the facility, the test center, or they simply black out the word Area 51, they being the redactors at the CIA, it did allow me a sort of way in to discuss programs. And as the way that I reported the book was, Lovick, you know, said, oh, well, you should meet my friend Bob Murphy. He was the mechanic, and he went on to do great things for Lockheed for 30 years out there. And then I would speak to Bob Murphy, and then he would say, well, you should really talk to this guy. And that is how I was able to have access to these 32 men who lived and worked at Area 51 for extended periods of time.
Yeah. And what seems really clear is that these guys were actually very proud of the work that they had done, that they felt that this was something that had played a very important role in U.S. security, and perhaps now they were really pleased to actually have the opportunity to be able to talk about what they had done.
Yes, I certainly think so, although all of these men are incredibly humble, and keep in mind, they did all of the work that they did needing absolutely no credit and being relatively certain that they would never get it, certainly not in their lifetimes. And so I think in a lovely way, there is that sense of, as they were discussing with me, and I was, you know, really just amazed at some of these programs, and tell me more details, because the details are incredible. And when you think that these guys had been working on these projects 50 years ago, in terms of memory, it was a bit of a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, they never were able to share it with, say, their wives or their family members when it was going on. But the intensity of the programs and the great national security involved. I mean, we were engaged in an almost thermonuclear war with the Soviets for across, you know, the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And so this intensity with which they worked made for a lot of very precise, very sharp memories that even though these men are in the third act of their lives now, they were able to share them with me with impeccable clarity.
Yeah. So if people are interested in seeing what these planes, either the A-12 or the SR-71 looks like, you can, if you have a computer and internet access, you just put those things in and there you can see pictures of what they look like. And looking at these planes and knowing how fast they were and the fact that around this area they were testing them seems at least to offer an explanation of this association that people have between UFOs and Area 51.
Yes, and also I learned from the research that I did that the CIA kept extensive UFO files because of this and also for other reasons. But if you look at the 1950s when the U-2 started flying at Area 51, on the West Coast, the U-2 flights accounted for almost half of the West Coast UFO sightings. And so the CIA did need to keep involved in them because this was a secret program. And the Air Force, who was in charge of investigating UFO claims at the time for a project called Blue Book, had to kind of coordinate with the CIA to figure out, okay, well, what about this flight? Oh, and the CIA would say, well, you don't have a need to know about that one, i.e. it was the U-2. Mm-hmm. And then imagine in the 1960s, along comes this A-12 ox cart, which is odd-shaped. It looks kind of like a flying swan. Some call it the titanium goose. It has an incredibly long neck and a large, broad, delta-shaped wing that's filled with fuel. Imagine the kind of fuel it takes to fly 2,300 miles an hour. And this aircraft, the A-12 Oxcart, also flies at 90,000 feet, which is 17 miles up. Imagine a commercial aircraft flying along over, let's say, Nevada, heading toward California at 35,000 feet. And the pilot and the passengers look up, and they see miles above them something go shooting by, reflecting the sun, which is still up on the west, you know, out on the West Coast. And that made for a lot of UFO sightings. Commander Slater, who was in charge of the base at the time and is one of the men I interview in the book, told me about how many times they had to get the FBI on the phone. The FBI would meet that commercial airplane wherever it was landing, say in Los Angeles, make the pilot and the passengers sign inadvertent disclosure forms saying, you didn't see anything.
And you can also understand why the U.S., why the military, those people who knew that these planes existed, why they would be concerned about sightings and would want to keep track of them, because they knew they had these planes. Well, they also figured that perhaps the Soviet Union also had these planes. So if it wasn't one of ours that had been sighted, it's possible that it might have been one of theirs.
And also the real fear at the time was that the Soviets were working so hard on their missile technology, because the Soviets knew we were building spy planes. They actually knew about Area 51 almost when the base opened, because as soon as their satellites were up, they were tracking Area 51 and their satellites. And in fact, many of the scientists, including Edward Lovick, talk about walking around the base with Soviet spy satellite schedules in their front pocket. And they would have to stop what they were doing and hide the aircraft in a hangar when the Soviet satellite would go around on its 90-minute cycle. And so there was this idea that, you know, the Soviets were watching us, we were going to spy on them, they were building missiles. It was sort of the military-industrial complex gone mad.
And was there a Russian, maybe it still is, a Russian equivalent of Area 51?
Yes, and it's a place called N-288, and during the 50s, the CIA did not know about it for the beginning half of the 60s, and then when they found out about it, they were very concerned because the fear was that the Soviets had all their German scientists that they had pillaged after World War II, same as we had under Operation Paperclip, that's where the German scientists were working with the Soviet scientists to build something, you know, that was going to be better than we had. And of course, in 1957, the big reveal of what it was they were working on came clear in October of that year when Sputnik launched. Mm-hmm. That is where Sergei Korolev built Sputnik.
We have a caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We'll talk with someone right here, and they're in Champaign. Hello.
When was the SR-71 decommissioned? Because in 1984, I went to Edwards Air Force Base for an air show, and it was there, but it was off in the horizon. You weren't allowed to get anywhere near it. And then they fueled it up and flew it by the crowd so you can get a good picture, and then they showed it once, go by, and it hit off its afterburners to show you how powerful of a plane it was. And then about 6 years ago, I was out in California again, I drove by an air museum, and there is one of them sitting there, and you can walk right up to it and everything. So I'm like, when was that plane decommissioned?
In the 1990s, and there's a great website called Habu, HABU.org, which you can get all kinds of information about the SR-71.
Yeah, and the guy that was running the museum, he said one of the old pilots there, he says two of them are still being in use, but they won't admit it. All right, well, thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, have just, maybe this is a small side point, but now that that satellite technology is so sophisticated, is there still a place for this kind of thing, an aircraft that actually has a human pilot in it?
That's a great question, and many people want to know what's going on out at Area 51 now, including me, but all of those programs are classified, and everything in that I write in the book is at the end of the book about what's going on there now is suggestive. Certainly, we know the drones are being test flown out there, and we know that manned aircraft are being moved out of the way for unmanned aircraft. But there is still some arguments of why a manned aircraft is going to be a better espionage platform. And keep in mind, the U-2, which was first built in 1955 at Area 51, is still flying today.
Well, I talked at the beginning of the program about the fact that, you know, people have this association between Area 51 and secret government programs. And that perhaps the thing that people think of are, they think of this stuff that has to do with UFOs and aliens, that sort of thing. And in fact, that there has been, there continues to be secret work, secret military work there. But that the work that they're doing now, and perhaps the work that has been done and that you write about in the book, is something completely different from what people think about. And the fact is that, this area, not just Area 51, but also the adjacent areas and people who worked in Area 51, was a place where a lot of testing was done on nuclear weapons. Definitely something that the U.S. government would want to keep secret, both for security reasons, but also because when you hear about the details of some of the things that they'd done, you have to wonder, was this actually necessary? That would be one question. And, you know, what sort of environmental impact did these things have? Maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the things that were done with nuclear weapons there.
Yes, well, let's look first at what the doctrine is that we were up against, and it was called MAD. Mutual Assured Destruction. That was the idea of building up as many nuclear weapons as possible in our arsenal, knowing that the Soviets were doing the same, so that if anybody wanted to launch a first strike, the enemy would be able to launch a response strike, and both missiles would destroy both countries before, you know, anyone could say boo, and that therefore it would never happen. So it's kind of a strange elliptical way of going at national security, but nonetheless, that was the doctrine of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, really, and on some level still is today. And whether what you think about that, what I think about that, certainly older people, all of the Cold War heroes tend to believe that is what kept us safe. But in building up the nuclear arsenal, there were a lot of tests that had to take place, according to the Department of Defense and the Atomic Energy Commission, which is now called the Department of Energy. And what I do write in the book is where I feel many of these tests, several of them in particular, verged on reckless and dangerous. And they were all called safety tests. But they didn't seem to be so safe to me when I investigated them. And I'll give you an example that took place right there at Area 51. Up in the northwest corner of Area 51, a land parcel was cut off and designated Area 13. And the Department of Defense and Atomic Energy Commission decided that they wanted to see what would happen if a U.S. airplane carrying a thermonuclear warhead were to crash on American soil. Would the bomb actually explode? Would it create a mushroom cloud? Or would something else happen, which is the equivalent of what we know today as a dirty bomb? And so they set off a test at Area 13, and what the result was that 895 acres of land were and still are contaminated by plutonium. And we know that plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. So this is a land parcel that has been destroyed forever. And, you know, I tell the story in my book through the eyes of the security guard who actually watched over that land parcel when it was being tested. And his name is Richard Mingus. And going back to your question of did this keep us safe and secure, you know, when you hear it from a firsthand source like Richard Mingus that says, who's alive and well today, by the way, that was an important safety test, you are, hopefully the reader is able to, you know, say to themselves, what do I think and what conclusions do I draw and where does that take us today?
Yeah. Well, it certainly, this was a concern at the time because as part of our deterrent strategy, we had planes in the air with nuclear weapons. And so there was a justifiable concern that if something happened, some technical thing, the plane was hit, you know, whoever, who knows what, and the plane crashed, you don't want the bomb to explode. So you can understand why they would have this concern. Although it's kind of ironic that it actually did happen. A plane carrying nuclear weapons did crash. It happened in Spain, and it did cause a serious problem. But it seemed that they didn't really, this test that you talk about, it wasn't very instructive. It seemed like they didn't really learn anything, or if they did, it didn't end up being applied to this cleanup of this, and it was a very serious problem resulting from this crash in Spain.
You know, absolutely, and that was a place where I sort of made my own opinion about whether I thought Project 57 was really a true safety test or whether it was reckless, and my conclusion was that it was reckless for exactly that reason, because when I did research about the Palomares crash where these a SAC bomber was refueling over Spain, and there was a problem with the boom and the plane exploded. The thermonuclear bombs fell to Earth. The pilot, miraculously, and his crew were able to eject. They landed in the sea. The thermonuclear bombs, which had parachutes on them, were supposed to land gently on the ground, but a couple of them actually crashed into the Earth at Palomares and did exactly what the Department of Defense was worried about, which is spread plutonium across the land. And what I found stunning was that the land at Area 13, adjacent to Area 51, having been already contaminated by plutonium, would have been a perfect way for the Department of Defense to figure out how, and the Atomic Energy Commission, how do you clean up a contaminated site? And, in fact, they had not cleaned it up out there at Area 13. So when the scientists, it was a team of 500 people, went in to clean up the land at Palomares that was contaminated with plutonium, in essence, they had no idea what they were doing.
And still today, the areas out, some of the areas around Area 51 are heavily contaminated with radioactivity. And actually, for that reason, one of the things that they do out there is that they train people who might have to respond to some kind of nuclear incident. And the reason that they do the training is there is because it's real. They're real world conditions in the sense that they're working in an atmosphere where there is nuclear, where there already is contamination from radiation.
Yes, that is where the Department of Homeland Security now trains its post-nuclear incident responders.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll go to Avon, Indiana, on our toll-free line right here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello there. Good morning.
Yes.
A couple of questions, please. First, Area 51, there are some people, kooks, as I refer to them, running around saying that basically it served its purpose. It's been shut down because too much publicity, and a new site has been developed or will be developed in western Colorado. Any comment about that? And then the second question, you have the two big air shows, you know, once a year. They're in Europe, Paris and Farnborough. Do they display any part or any of their research that they're doing there for potential sales or whatever?
The first part of the question, Area 51 is alive and well. If you look on Google Earth, the images are usually several months, if not a year old, but you can see what's going on at Area 51, and it's only getting bigger. Larger runways, bigger hangars. There's also the suggestion that many things have moved underground, and that is because satellites can pick up such clear images of what's happening on the ground now, and those would be, you know, foreign satellites. About displaying technology, absolutely not. I mean, the technology that is built and tested out at Area 51 is so important to national security that the government goes to great lengths to keep it that way. I'll give you an example from the 1960s, so you can imagine what it's like today, but this is in the 1960s. I write about this in the book. A CIA pilot, incredible pilot named Ken Collins, is flying the A-12 Oxcart on a test flight out of Area 51. Something goes wrong with his altimeter, so he can't, the plane is misjudging the speed. The nose goes up, the plane flips over and begins to crash. Well, Collins knows that you cannot recover the plane from this kind of an inverted spin. He ejects, the plane crashes, he lands in Utah, and he is standing there picking up his papers, going in his mind through the protocol of what the CIA has him do in the event, and lo and behold, coming riding across the desert floor are three ranchers in a pickup truck, and they have the canopy of his million-dollar spy plane in the back of their truck. Well, Collins does as he was told, which is that he says to the ranchers, who the ranchers say to him, by the way, "Hop in, pilot, we're going to take you to your airplane." And he says, "You can't go anywhere near the aircraft. It has a nuclear bomb on board," which was the cover story. The ranchers say, "We're taking you to the police station and we're getting out of town." And that is how that safety and security of everything technologically advanced on that plane was kept. Immediately, the CIA dispatched a crew from Area 51 to go clean up that crash site inch by inch, square by square, to make sure nothing was left behind.
Yeah. We're talking this morning with Annie Jacobson. That story is one that you will be able to read in her new book that looks at the history of Area 51. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast is provided by Freestar Bank, since 1934, working with local businesses and individuals to help them reach their goals with products like new mortgages or business loans. Information on financial products and services available at any local Freestar branch or online at freestarbank.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. We're here with 10 topics every week. In the second hour today, we'll talk about state and federal pension issues with Jeffrey Brown. He's professor of finance at the University of Illinois. Tomorrow morning, we'll have some archives. In the first hour, we'll repeat a show from March, conversation with Doug Saunders. He's a journalist and wrote a book titled Arrival City, How the Largest Migration in History is Reshaping Our World. It takes a look at how many places around the world people are moving from rural areas to urban ones, and what that means on a variety of levels. Then we'll also have a couple of more shows in this thing that we're doing. We're calling the Deep Archives, this to celebrate the 30th anniversary of this show, Focus. These are programs that have not been heard in a very long time, and we'll have a couple more for you tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. If you'd like to find out what's going on this program or listen to past shows that you might have missed first time around, you can go to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Annie Jacobson. She's contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine, an investigative reporter, and author of the new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. It is published by Little Brown. And we will go back here and talk next with somebody on our line number one, someone who's calling on a cell phone right here. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David. Great show. I'm on a cell phone, and I joined the conversation rather late, so excuse me if the topic was covered. Two quick questions, and I'll go ahead and ring off. I was wondering if the guest already hasn't spoken about this, if she could speak to how much power the Atomic Energy Commission has and its ability to act independently, even from the knowledge of the president. And then to skip ahead, probably the most provocative part of the story is if the guest could speak as to what was discovered in the desert and the people who were driving or flying the ship and her take on how this came to be. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for that question and also your understanding that the idea that the Atomic Energy Commission was set up with a power structure that was separate from the president was certainly astonishing to me when I first began researching it. Obviously, the Constitution was written so that the president had the national security executive secret-keeping power, and yet the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 allowed the Atomic Energy Commission to have its own system of secret-keeping, which is separate from the presidential system. And many scholars call this unanswerable authority. And what that means is that the AEC was able to create secrets that would be born classified and stay that way indefinitely. And this speaks to the greater issue of my book of what let's call the Lord Acton quote, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. A number of the heroes in my book, I write about how you know, they are so able to steer the course. Their moral character never changes, no matter how much power they are given. They're always able to lead men with courage and principle. But what happens to other men is they become swayed by, let's say, hubris or power, and they begin to get the sense that they are greater than those around them. And that is always historically how people run into trouble, and Area 51 is no exception to that archetypal story. There's a man called Vannevar Bush, who I write about in my book. He was in charge of the Manhattan Project, which was the bid to build the atomic bomb during World War II. Many people think Leslie Groves was in charge, but in fact, Vannevar Bush was the boss of Leslie Groves, and he reported directly to the president. And the program that I write about in the end of the book, to which your caller refers, is a program that was also run by Vannevar Bush, had been completely unknown to the public before it was revealed to me by a source that I had been working with for 2 years. And that program, he said, involved a foreign ship that had come from Russia and crashed in the desert in New Mexico, as much of the Roswell lore says, but it was not from Mars, it was actually from Russia, and that equipment and the aviators inside of it were brought to the Nevada desert in 1951, hence the name Area 51.
Hmm. This story, I think, probably has gotten more attention, at least from what I've read about the book, has gotten almost more attention than anything else in the book. And I think that if that was not there, the book still would have been worthy of attention for the things that you write about, for the work there that people did with developing spy planes and also all these various, sometimes hair-raising experiments that were done with nuclear weapons. But because people have this association between UFOs, aliens, and Area 51, this is obviously the thing that's going to get a lot of people's attention. And it's a story that it seems so incredible, and so over the top, you just don't want to believe it. And I think that also with all due respect, some people have questioned the fact that you only have one source for the story. Now, I know that it's somebody that you say that you spent a lot of time talking with and that you believed, but the idea that the Soviets had their own former Nazi scientists who were working on an exotic flying disc-shaped craft, that the Russians would have surgically altered some teenagers to make them look like aliens, put them in this craft, and sent it over the United States. It crashed, and that the reason that the Russians had done it was they were just trying to freak out the Americans because they knew everybody was kind of on edge about the whole issue of UFOs and aliens. That just seems like it's almost too much to believe.
And I absolutely understand why people would be skeptical of it. And imagine that certainly was my reaction when it was first told to me by a trusted source that I was working with on an entirely different issue related to the book. Mm-hmm. But the reason I made the decision to put it in was because I wrote Area 51, the uncensored history, not the censored history. And I was able to get documentation that, while it's by no means corroborated the story, it certainly raises a lot of other questions that I think people should be asking. And the number one would be a file that is declassified by the Defense Intelligence Agency, what used to be called G2 Army Intelligence, a 300-page file that was declassified in the 1990s. And what it discusses is this fall of 1947 European manhunt for two former Nazi scientists named Reimar and Walter Horton, who are best known for inventing the flying wing, but who were also experimenting with round-shaped aircraft. And all across Europe, these army intelligence officers sought the brothers because they wanted to find out if they had made a flying disc. And if you read through this 300-page file, you know, it reads like a wild goose chase at times and like a spy novel at other times. And in the very end, there's a cable back from Europe that says the Horton brothers have been found and they admitted contact with the Russians. And the file ends there. And all my attempts to get that further information declassified have fallen on deaf ears at the Pentagon. But one must really ask, when you line up the information that the engineer told me about the flying disc, you add into the mix all of this mythology about Roswell, which comes from somewhere, and then you look at the Operation Harass declassified files, there certainly are a lot more questions than there are answers. Mm.
And you would have to, though, wonder why at all of this time now later, Soviet Union's gone, Cold War's over. You know, we're talking about something that happened 50 years ago, more than 50 years ago. Why it is that at this point anybody would think that that would still need to be classified?
Well, because the nature of, I mean, if you're talking about human experiments, it's such a horrific concept, and it's in direct violation of the Nuremberg Code of 1947. So I can't imagine any nation wanting to admit ever having to have been involved in anything like that, although unfortunately the United States continues to have to admit to these kind of programs. Just last October, Hillary Clinton went on television, apologized to Guatemalans for the fact that had been revealed by a researcher searching in the National Archives, discovered that, lo and behold, our scientists had gone into mental institutions in Guatemala, pulled out patients, and infected them with syphilis. This is just astonishingly horrific practice by American scientists. We did it. We did it in the name of science. And these kind of things do exist. Part of why I felt it was so important as a journalist to present this information is because in most of those situations, people kind of turn the other cheek and just go on with their day. Oh, the Guatemalans, sorry about that. This is a very sensitive issue because it deals with the Roswell. And I believe that what my source told me is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. The other thing, and again, I suppose in a way this is kind of a rhetorical question, but you have to wonder, it's such a good story. The impulse to tell it must be very strong. There would be a lot of people who would want to hear it. Also, you would have to figure there would have to be a significant number of people probably still alive who would have personal knowledge of this. How do you keep the lid on something like that this long?
Well, not according to my source, because, you know, and I also interviewed his family members, and they clearly were not familiar with what he knew. And as my source told me, and I write in the book, he was one of five engineers who worked on this program under the direction of Vannevar Bush. And all of the men had top secret clearances for other work that they were doing with the Atomic Energy Commission. They also all had Q clearances, which allows you to work with nuclear information. And they all knew from their other projects that the project that they worked on, any project they worked on, was born classified and could stay classified. And so to work on a program like this, which is very questionable in terms of its morality, I doubt would be something that you would really want to share unless it was a matter of conscience, which it is with my source, which is why he told me.
All right. Well, we have some other callers here. In the time that remains, we want to get them in, and we'll go next to Champagne and line number one. Hello.
Oh, hello there. Since the number of explosions that we executed in 51 is huge, but a long time ago, what's the comparison of the biological effects on the area as compared to the better-known biological effects that have occurred in the Chernobyl explosion and recovery, which has happened pretty much as far as I can see?
Yes, it's a great question, and there's what I learned from nuclear scientists is there's a difference between when an atomic bomb is exploded in the atmosphere and the radiation disperses first in the mushroom cloud and then by the wind, which creates its own set of problems, versus the meltdown of a nuclear reactor, which is what happened at Chernobyl, which is what happened recently in Japan. And the meltdown causes the spewing of chunks of radiation out into the atmosphere, very different biological effects. But as I write in the book in a chapter called Meltdown, we actually did melt down a nuclear rocket reactor out in the desert in a place called Area 25, about 16 miles from Area 51. The government wanted to see what would happen if something melted down. And so
is there any good reason why we do not send our atomic waste instead of in the form of pellets and bullets and whatever things abroad, why they're not sent back to the areas where the uranium is mined and simply redeposited back in the ground?
Well, that's an area that I'm not an expert in, but what I can tell you is that when you hear people talking about Yucca Mountain and the project to move nuclear waste to Yucca Mountain, they are actually talking about Area 25. That is where Yucca Mountain is located.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the caller and get at least one more. We'll go to Effingham, line number 4. Hello?
Yes, thank you. I heard the author speak on Fresh Air some weeks ago, and two things bothered me a great deal. One was the fact that there was supposedly collaboration between Stalin and Dr. Joseph Mengele, and I can't imagine that the Russians would have let Mengele out of their grasp had they had him. And secondly, it seems to me if the Russians wanted to scare us, they wouldn't have crashed a disc out in the Nevada desert. They would have crashed it in New York City. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, again, for the collaboration between Stalin and Mengele, I relay all the information very clearly as it was told to me by my source, with me not speculating but just saying this is what I was told. The second part of the question is very interesting, but keep in mind that in 1947, what we know is the New Mexico desert was actually one of the most secret or the most important military areas in the United States in a triangle. You had Los Alamos, the nuclear weapons lab, then you had Sandia, which is where the weapons were assembled and made, and then you had the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell Air Base, which was those were where the only planes that could actually transport a nuclear weapon were based out of. So it was a very key area to Stalin.
So the idea would be that this craft, if it did exist, was actually doing spying there, and that's why it was in that area?
No, you know, I noticed that some of the press reports had suggested that, and nowhere in my book do I write that. The source told me that what was sent over to crash in New Mexico was a psychological operation by Joseph Stalin, a black operation, propaganda, to a warning shot over Truman's bow, a way of saying, you have the nuclear bomb, but we have psychological operations.
We're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. I guess one of the things that really strikes me about the reaction to the book is, again, I suppose it clusters around this particular story, that on the one hand, people are concerned that they say, well, maybe it's a little thinly sourced, and they're even surprised that you included it, and you explained why you did. But also, and maybe not surprisingly, there seem to be a lot of people who think that you either wittingly or unwittingly are part of the cover-up, and that what you're doing here is you're helping to disperse government-generated or government-approved disinformation, and that, again, they continue to believe that there's more here than meets the eye, and that you're helping you're assisting in the cover-up.
And, you know, the mystery of Area 51 will only continue in that regard. But two thoughts on that. I got a note recently from a conspiracy group in the United Kingdom, and they said, look, even we don't believe you, which is a bit of a backhand compliment. But also what comes to mind is what Winston Churchill said about Russia. He said it's an enigma wrapped inside a puzzle, wrapped inside a riddle. And I think the same can be said about Area 51.
Hmm. And just, I guess, the thing that's interesting about Area 51 is that when you look at the various stories that are told about it, for example, one thing that we haven't touched on, there is this other conspiracy theory that says that the United States never really went to the moon, that the whole thing was fake, and that, in fact, the shots that we saw that were purported to be astronauts on the moon actually were shot there at Area 51. And interestingly enough, the area there where it's all torn up by bombs apparently was actually used to train the Apollo astronauts in moonwalking. So that shows you how a little kernel of something that's actually true can get elaborated on and embroidered upon, and it can become something completely different, but it actually started out as being something that was true.
And that is all part of the legend of Area 51. We find the same thing with the reverse engineering. We find the same thing with the underground tunnels. In the legends of Area 51, there is often a thread of truth.
And just also the tunnel thing, that's another thing that's pretty interesting, that there is this idea that somehow there are these secret military installations, and then they're connected by this gigantic network of tunnels. And I gather that there around Area 51 there are some tunnels, but it's nothing like what people think of.
Yes, and some conspiracy theorists that I interviewed told me adamantly that they believed, and their group believed, that beneath Area 51 was this tunnel system that connected it to other military bases all across America. What I found out in my research is that at the Nevada test site next door to Area 51, there are, in fact, dozens of underground tunnels and chambers. One I discovered was at least 4,500 feet down. That's almost a mile. And the purpose of these underground tunnels and chambers was to explode nuclear weapons after the 1963 moratorium that made it illegal to explode nuclear weapons in the atmosphere.
Mm. So again, yes, tunnels, and they did actually have a purpose, but it's not what people were thinking about.
And here's another kind of interesting idea I'll leave you with, which is that I interviewed the man who's in charge of the running operations at the test site now, the nuclear side of things. And, of course, we are not allowed to test any nuclear weapons that actually create, an explosion, even underground. But there's a facility I learned in Area 1 that is where scientists conduct what are called subcritical nuclear tests. So they take it right up to the edge of explosion. And that facility is 1,000 feet underground. The scientists go down in an elevator below Area 1 to get to it. But since there's no way of knowing of what's going on there, we'll just have to take the government's word at it.
So how, just as a way of finishing up, how do you feel now that forever after, who knows for how long, you and your name are going to be linked with some sort of wacky stuff?
Well, I think what I really keep the focus on is my name being linked with these amazing 74 men, 32 of whom I really get into telling their stories, who actually lived and worked at Area 51 and did these incredible projects that kept the nation safe for decades.
Well, there's a lot of interesting stories in here in the book, and if you want to read about it, the title of the book is Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. The book is published by Little Brown by our guest Annie Jacobson. She is a contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine. Ms. Jacobson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.